From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Yesterday, President Bush traveled to El Salvador and was met with thousands of protesters who were protesting his policies of trade and the war on terrorism.
We'll take a look at Bush's tour through Latin America. We'll go to Mexico, El Salvador, and Peru. Then protests at the Federal Communication Commission.
A band of protesters dressed as angels went to protest Michael Powell's policies of dismembering all controls on media ownership.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! Breaking the sound barrier. Today, we'll look at breaking the race barrier. I'm Amy Goodman. Setting precedents and shattering dubious tradition, Halle Berry became the Oscars' first Black Best Actress last night for her performance in Monsters Ball. Denzel Washington was named the first Black Best Actor since 1963 for Training Day, and the two became the first ever pair of African Americans honored for their performances, all at the 74th Annual Academy Awards. This news internationally. The U.S. military flew in a small group of highly lethal A-10s or Warthogs to a base north of Kabul on Saturday night to provide additional support for U.S. operations. It's the first time the military has stationed fixed-wing combat aircraft inside Afghanistan. Warthogs are heavily armored and built to survive direct hits from highly explosive projectiles. They can fire some 4,000 rounds a minute and can also carry bombs and missiles. Meanwhile, the first part of a deployment of 1,700 British Royal Marines arrived at the Bagram base over the weekend. They're expected to stay about 90 days and will be used to watch the backcountry passes along the mountainous border between Afghanistan and Pakistan. Senior officers have said operations are being planned against two or three remaining pockets of Al-Qaeda fighters and their allies in eastern and southern Afghanistan. Afghan authorities arrested two soldiers allied to U.S. forces today. They allegedly opened fire on Sunday on the region's security chief, killing a bodyguard and wounding two others. Afghan authorities said the assailants were believed to have been allies of the United States and took refuge in the U.S. fortified airport compound. The security chief of Khost province, Sir Ghul, was said to have escaped uninjured. The assailants were believed to have opened fire on the security chief because he had tried to disarm them a day earlier in the Khost public market. Maryland's House of Delegates is preparing to pass anti-terrorism legislation that would dramatically expand the ability of police to tap phones and eavesdrop on email and internet activity of suspected criminals. Like the Patriot Act, proposals in Maryland and a new law in Virginia permit law enforcement officials to get court orders to retrieve records of emails and other electronic communications, not just telephone records. Maryland's proposal would also expand the ability of police to tap phones by allowing investigators to plant a listening device indefinitely, not just 30 days. It would, for the first time, permit use of a roving wiretap to record a person's conversations on multiple phones with a single warrant, and it would allow a judge to seal search warrants for up to a year. The New York Times is reporting that Vice President Dick Cheney is encouraging Israel to allow Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat to go to the Arab Summit meeting in Beirut this week. It's a development that would require Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon to lift his travel ban on Arafat. But Cheney also disclosed he had no immediate plans to meet with Arafat because the Palestinian leader, he said, had not met with American conditions. These conditions include taking steps to establish a ceasefire and stopping so-called terrorist attacks. Meanwhile, as the United States tries to push its version of a truce in the Middle East, Israeli military planners are preparing for a major assault on Palestinian cities, towns, and refugee camps. According to Israeli officials, the assault will be broader and deeper than the offensive taken earlier this month. Labor activists and the family members of union leaders assassinated at a giant coal mine in Colombia are suing the largest mining company in Alabama for complicity in the murders. The United Steelworkers of America and the International Labor Rights Fund say there's evidence that the gunmen who murdered the union president and his deputy were working for the Drummond Company of Birmingham, Alabama. Papers filed earlier this month with a federal court in Birmingham show the unionists asked Drummond for protection following threats from right-wing paramilitaries who control much of the land around the mining town of La Loma. But the company rejected a request from the union leaders to sleep in the mine and was hostile to the membership drive that prompted 1,000 mine workers at La Loma to join a union. Up to 30,000 people around Australia rallied Sunday to protest against the government's policy of detaining asylum seekers. Leading religious, political, and academic figures joined the protests, which were held in cities all over the country. The government uses Navy ships to patrol waters between Indonesia and northern Australia to prevent people smugglers dumping boatloads of asylum seekers along the remote coastline. Those caught are sent to detention centers set up by Australia on the impoverished Pacific nations of Papua New Guinea and Nauru until their asylum applications have been processed. In addition to the government's so-called Pacific solution, thousands of asylum seekers are also being held in camps around Australia.
This is my appeal to you, the rank and file, who serve as guards, police, and garrison. My brothers, you are all from among the same people, but at your hands, your people die. In the name of God, listen to the cries of the suffering. Rise up to the heavens. Why, I beseech you, order you, beg you. Alto la repression. Above all commands, you're given by man. The law of love must stand, and thou shalt not kill. Above any order, you're given by a soldier. The law of God says only to love. In the name of God, listen to the cries of a suffering. Rise up to the heavens. Why, I beseech you, order you, beg you. Brothers, I assure you, you are not obliged to obey one who tells you to kill your people. Now reclaim your conscience, now reclaim your people. Even you, a soldier, can. In the name of God, listen to the cries of the suffering.
Colleen Katow and Jolie Christine Rickman, songs to close the School of the Americas as they sang the words of Romero. You are listening to Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. Sunday was the 22nd anniversary of the assassination of Archbishop Oscar Romero, one of El Salvador's great human rights leaders. It was also the last day of President Bush's so-called tour of Latin America, a tour that ended in a six-hour visit to El Salvador. During that visit, Bush met and dined with the Salvadoran president, Francisco Flores, the same man who famously dedicated his presidency to the army major responsible for Romero's assassination. Bush's visit was met by protests both in and outside of the country. Today, we're going to the same countries that President Bush went to. We'll go to Mexico and Peru, but we'll begin in El Salvador. And because the news headlines are all dominated by the Oscars and the movie industry, we thought we'd go back to a very important film. It was called Romero, and it starred Raul Julia. And this was Raul Julia's rendition of the speech that Oscar Romero gave, an excerpt of it that was heard throughout El Salvador when he would broadcast on radio in his cathedral, when he would speak to different people. Raul Julia in Romero.
I hope that this call of the church does not further harden the hearts of the rich and the powerful, but will move them to conversion. You are the principal protagonists in this hour of change. On you depends in great part the end of violence. There is no clinging to our feudal past. This is a new age. An age in which all God's children may live in peace, freedom, and dignity. I'd like to make an appeal in a special way to the men in the army. Brothers, each one of you is one of us. We are the same people. The farmers and peasants that you kill are your own brothers and sisters. When you hear the words of a man telling you to kill, think instead in the words of God, "Thou shalt not kill." No soldier is obliged to obey an order contrary to the law of God. In his name, and in the name of our tormented people who have suffered so much and whose laments cry out to heaven, I implore you, I beg you, I order you, stop the repression!
Raul Julia playing Archbishop Oscar Romero in the film Romero. And you are listening to Democracy Now! As we go now to San Salvador, where there were major protests on Sunday of President Bush's trip on this 22nd anniversary of the assassination of the Archbishop. William Hernandez, a representative of the FMLN, is standing by. Welcome to Democracy Now!, William.
Thank you.
It's good to have you with us. Can you describe what happened in the streets as President Bush landed in El Salvador?
I think that one of the most important things is that the people realize that besides commemorating the 22nd anniversary of the death of Bishop Romero, that we have to fight against the the free trade agreements that the Central American presidents would like to sign with the United States. Also was marked with people from Nicaragua, from Honduras, and Nicaragua. In Guatemala, excuse me. So means that the action yesterday not was just only by Salvadorans, but I think it was a Central American action that happened in San Salvador yesterday. And I think that's important because it's the first time that is happening, in the history of the struggle here in Central America. Even though the government try to prevent those people to coming into the country, like the people who were coming from Honduras and Nicaragua were stopped at the border, and they were all there for the whole night. But I think yesterday that the march, the actions, were marked by really anti-imperialist sentiments against not United States people, but against United States government and its policies. and also demanding what our Bishop Romero used to demand 22 years ago, justice, dignity, human rights, all of the things that until now, 22 years after, we don't have that kind of things that Bishop Romero was demanding. So I think it was very militant and peaceful at the same time. And we believe that around 10 to 15,000 people mobilized in the streets of San Salvador. And not to mention that also in the western part of El Salvador, there were actions. Also in the eastern part of El Salvador were actions on Saturday, the 23rd.
We're also joined in the studio by Shireen Herzog, who is executive director of the Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador. Last night in Harlem at St. Mary's Church, there was an event commemorating the assassination of Archbishop Romero. And you specifically talked about events today, human rights and economic rights, specifically CAFTA. Can you explain what that is?
Right. One of the main reasons that President Bush was traveling to El Salvador was to promote free trade, specifically the Central America Free Trade Agreement, which the U.S. is negotiating with five countries in Central America. They see it as an important step in getting the free trade area of the Americas passed, and they talk about this promote as something that will promote democracy and increase development in the region, even though at this point in time, more than 250,000 people in Guatemala are on the verge of starvation, and more than 42,000 families in eastern El Salvador alone are on the verge of starvation, according to the World Food Organization.
A lot of people here know about NAFTA, do not know about CAFTA.
That's true. It's actually something that's just come into the press in the last couple of weeks with the trip that Bush is taking to El Salvador. He announced on January 16th, a somewhat ironic day, the anniversary of the peace accords in El Salvador. President Bush announced that he was going to be putting a big effort into getting CAFTA passed. It's referred to as CAFTA because it's basically going to be modeled exactly after NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. And as we saw with NAFTA, which has done nothing to benefit working conditions, environmental conditions, or human rights in Mexico, the U.S., or Canada, we don't expect that it will do anything to benefit the conditions of people in Central America either.
We're going to come back to El Salvador, but our guest in Peru has to leave to go into a session of the Peruvian Parliament. We're joined by Javier Diaz-Canseco in Lima, Peru. As President Bush went to Peru, there were thousands of police and military personnel. And Saturday, demonstrators chanting, "Bush, get out of Peru," before they were sent running by clouds of tear gas, saying, "We don't want to be a North American colony, down with Yankee imperialism." Javier Diaz-Canseco, can you talk about the reception of the U.S. president in your country, Peru?
Good morning, first of all. I'd like to thank you for this opportunity to speak about what the Peruvian and U.S. relations could be in the future. The visit of Mr. Bush to Peru has obviously been seen as a political issue, a political visit, which basically we feel is the idea of looking for a new partner in South America after the collapse of the Argentinian government and of the Argentinian economy. We feel that those that are critical of this relationship, that the United States are looking for a partner that can represent its interest in South America, trying to understand why is Peru being chosen for this purpose. What I think is that there are several reasons. On one hand, I believe that Mr. Bush is trying to find another partner in the Colombia plan, which is under execution now in Colombia. The U.S. has a military base in Mantas, in Ecuador. It has also a military base in Bolivia, and it has military presence in Colombia. And I think that still will not permit the use of the Brazilian Amazon area for a basis, they are working this idea in Peru. That is why they are selling the idea that terrorism and drug trafficking are the same thing. And they're trying to deal both things as if they were one, so that in the struggle against drug trafficking, they can also deal with terrorism and military options. I think this is one of the basic purposes that President Bush brought to Peru, and I think that probably he will obtain some of the things he is looking for. On the second hand, I feel that he came here, and I'm informed that a large amount of the hour he spent with President Toledo was speaking around the Peruvian vote against Cuba in Geneva next April in the Human Rights Commission, trying to find an argument to maintain the permanent blockade against Cuba. This is obviously a second issue that was dealt with in the visit. And, of course, I find that President Bush is trying to also deal country by country to find a way to the NAFTA agreement. And I feel that what President Bush is trying is to prevent the possibility of a Latin American union that can discuss with the United States the conditions of an agreement in ALCA or NAFTA. These are basically the things I feel that he came to deal with in Lima, Peru. And obviously, there was a great amount of policemen and armed forces in the streets. The city was almost like if it were deserted in several areas to prevent any kind of demand or protest against Mr. Bush's visit.
You are listening to Javier Diaz-Canseco, who is going into the Peruvian Parliament for his meeting right now. We're going to ask him to hold on for just a minute as we go to our break and then come back to our roundtable discussion. We'll also be going to Mexico with John Ross to talk about President Bush's visit there as well. You are listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
Hearing how business is tough in the Americas, how the union's at a hand. And I heard on the news today about the latest threat to my pay. Well, there's one thing I just want to understand. They say they can't afford our wages, so they turn their greedy eyes to distant shores. While patrols guard the border lines, and I'm standing on a picket line. In corporate boardrooms, plans are formed to move my job to Salvador, where for 50 cents a day, a woman sweats her life away, and they tell me she's mine.
So very far away.
Colleen Catau, Jolie Rickman, as they sing about Latin America, songs to close the School of the Americas. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. Congressmember Javier Diaz-Canseco had to go back into the Peruvian Congress as we take a whirlwind tour through Latin America. Following where President Bush went, he started in Mexico, went to Peru, and then came up to El Salvador, where we just heard a description of the protests there. John Ross, the author, is in Peru, is in Mexico, author and activist John Ross, and journalist. Can you tell us about the summit in Monterrey, Mexico, where Cuban President Fidel Castro left early?
Yeah, sure, Amy. Good to be on the show. George Bush's visit to Mexico was, it may have been just as destructive as his first visit here last February when he announced the bombing of Iraq from Vicente Fox's hacienda in Guanajuato. This time he came bearing bombs the same way. From what we've been able to reassemble last week, Condoleezza Rice advised the Mexican government that George Bush would not come to the Monterrey summit, a Monterrey United Nations summit on financing development, very important meeting, if Fidel Castro was here. Fidel Castro arrived on the night before Bush's visit, stay for a while, but at his speech before the summit the next day, probably the shortest speech that Fidel Castro ever made, 7 minutes, he announced that special conditions had forced him to leave the country. And I think that Cuba was not willing to accuse both the Mexican foreign minister, Jorge Castaneda, and George Bush on Mexican soil of trying to sabotage Fidel Castro's visit here. Fidel made a very strong speech at the summit, attacking the world economy as a big casino and pointing out the inadequacies in the amount of funding that was going to the extreme poor of the world. That was the intention of the summit, to find a way to finance the development to help the extremely poor out of poverty. Fidel Castro then stormed out and went back to Cuba, and in the days that have ensued since then, we've come to almost what a break in diplomatic relations between Mexico and Cuba. One of the Cuban papers today announced that they accused Bush of sabotaging the summit and of forcing Fidel Castro to leave.
Let me read a bit from Fidel Castro's speech. He said, "The existing world economic order constitutes a system of plundering and exploitation like no other in history. Thus, the peoples believe less and less in statements and promises. The prestige of the international financial institutions rates less than zero. The world economy is today a huge casino. Recent analyses indicate that for every dollar that goes into trade, over 100 end up in speculative operations completely disconnected from the real economy. As a result of this economic order, over 75% of the world population lives in underdevelopment, and extreme poverty has already reached 1.2 billion people in the third world. So far from narrowing, the gap is widening. The revenue of the richest nations that in 1960 was 37 times larger than that of the poorest is now 74 times larger. The situation has reached such extremes that the assets of the three wealthiest persons in the world amount to the GDP of the 48 poorest countries combined."
Right. Fidel Castro saying it like it is at a summit that was extremely important in trying to come up with some money to take care of the needs of 1.2 billion people, a fifth of the world planet, who live on less than a dollar a day. Let me point out that George Bush came bearing $5 billion over 3 years in aid to begin in 2004. If we break that down, it comes out to a little bit more than a dollar a year per capita for people that earn less than a dollar a day. And it Bush's offer was not very well received by the non-government organizations and by many of the third world nations who were here, that were here for the convention. There were 50 heads of state here. I might point out also that Fidel Castro received a step when he came off the stand at the summit, and George Bush did not. Yeah.
We're talking to John Ross, author, journalist, and activist. What about the streets? What about protests in Monterey?
Well, I think protest was not at a high level. Monterey is a very conservative city, and it's far from the center of the country, where and the south of the country, where the main protest forces are. I think that had something to do with it. There was an enormous police presence here. The first time that we had one of these anti-global meets was in Cancun a year ago, when the World Economic Forum, that was just in New York, came to Cancun, and people were beaten very, very severely. So I think that had something to do with keeping the crowds down. Also, this was a United Nations summit. It wasn't the World Bank, and it wasn't the IMF. And so I think people still have illusions about the United Nations. And so I think that kind of blunted the demonstrations. In all, there were about 10,000 people in the street at the at maximum moments of over five. It went on for 5 days, which is really just a small fraction of what had happened in Barcelona 2 days before at the European Union summit, when a 500,000 people hit the streets of Barcelona. So I think the Mexican movement still has a ways to go. We didn't have international representation at the demonstrations at the summit in the streets. It was mostly local farmers and Indians and organizations. It wasn't a big labor representation. And I think people were a little disappointed by the protests that developed in the streets.
Javier Diaz-Canseco, the protests in the streets in Peru. I think he did have to go off to his meeting in the Peruvian Congress. John Ross with us from Mexico, author of The War Against Oblivion, Zapatista Chronicles, and Roots of Rebellion. Also on the line with us, William Hernandez, who is in El Salvador. In the studio with us is the executive director of CISPACE, Shireen Horazuk. John Ross, President Bush, among his first acts when he was selected president in this country, is he went to Mexico. What about his relationship with Vicente Fox?
Well, I think relationship with Vicente Fox may be fine, but Vicente Fox's relationship with the rest of the country isn't very well. He's fallen below 50% in popularity, a plummet in the last couple of months, and it's basically because, as at the summit, Vicente Fox talks a good game, but he is just unable to deliver. Some of this has to do with the fact that he doesn't control Congress, and indeed the old party, the PRI, still controls Congress. I think we're going to see the conflict with Fidel Castro play out here, because you have to remember that the PRI, which controlled Mexico for 71 years, was very close to the Cuban government with some reservations over the years. In a real sense, the PRI was Fidel Castro's only friend amongst governments in Latin America. And I'm sure today, as Congress gets underway early this morning, we've already begun to see accusations from Congress of violating Cuba's sovereignty, of allowing George Bush to dictate this United Nations summit. And that will go on all week. There is information that Mexico's ambassador in Cuba, Ricardo Pascue, has been recalled. And certainly the Cuban ambassador here has returned to Havana for consultations. So I think we're looking at what the papers are saying. This is the most important diplomatic break between Cuba and Mexico since the Cuban Revolution.
As you listen to John Ross speak, Shireen Horazuk of the Committee in Solidarity of the People of El Salvador, the similarities with Mexico and Salvador in terms of the U.S. relationship.
Well, the U.S. definitely sees, I think, Mexico and El Salvador and all of Central America, perhaps all of Latin America, as their backyard. And this is particularly the viewpoint of the Bush administration and all of those people that he brought back from the previous Bush administration and the Reagan administration, who believe that they have every right in the world to control all of Latin America, that what is good for the U.S., whether or not it's good for Central America or Mexico, doesn't really matter. It's all about protecting U.S. interests.
We're also joined on the telephone by Dan Kovalik, who is with the United Steelworkers Union. Now, central to the meeting that Bush had, the meetings he had throughout Latin America, from Mexico to Peru to El Salvador, Colombia was always there. There was a lawsuit filed last week in Birmingham, Alabama, a lawsuit filed against the coal giant Drummond. Unions from Colombia have filed these suits against Drummond and a handful of other American companies doing business in Colombia, hoping to create legal and public pressure to stop the assassinations of union leaders. The Drummond Company has been accused of encouraging the assassination of three union leaders at its giant coal mine in Colombia. A union in Colombia and the families of the dead leaders assert that Drummond's Colombian managers signaled paramilitary gunmen that they wanted the officials killed. Can you tell us more about this lawsuit, Dan Kovalik, and why the United Steelworkers Union is involved with it?
Yes. As you indicated, we are suing Drummond for the claiming that they're responsible for the assassination of three trade unionists last year. Last March, March 12th, the vice president and president of the local mining union at their mines were murdered. They were dragged off of a company bus that was traveling from the mines to their home by paramilitaries. One was murdered on site. The other one was taken away, tortured, and then murdered. There were several company buses traveling from the mine that night. Only this one was stopped. They called for the union leaders by name, indicated that their beef was that with them was over their actions as unionists at Drummond, and they proceeded to kill them. As Gustavo Soler, another miner, indicated in an interview in The Nation sometime soon thereafter, he believed that the paramilitaries were told by someone at the mine what bus those unionists were on, and in order that the paramilitaries could apprehend them and kill them. Gustavo Soler later became president of that union. He himself was murdered by paramilitaries, again being dragged off a bus en route from the mines in October.
Dan Kovalik, how do the Colombian families of the union leaders know that it was paramilitary gunmen that were signaled by, that's how the New York Times put it on Friday, signaled by Drummond's Colombian managers?
Well, first of all, they know that it was paramilitaries because people recognize them as such. Moreover, the paramilitaries, and in this case the AUC, the largest paramilitary group, had been publicly denouncing the union at the Drummond Mines as a, quote, guerrilla union, unquote, and blaming them for some of the conduct that the guerrillas, some violent activities that the guerrillas had made against the mines. In addition, there are witnesses who, to the fact that there are management at these Drummond mines with open relations with the paramilitaries, that management at the mines provides the paramilitaries with various resources, including fuel for their vehicles. And the president of the mines himself had been making threats against the trade unionists before the murders. So in light of all those things, they believe that Drummond was responsible for this. Interestingly also, the trade unionists who were killed had gone to Drummond with a very simple request. For many months, they had been asking to stay overnight in the mines if they were working late for their own protection because they feared violence from the paramilitaries. The company flatly refused this request, and they specifically refused the request that was made the very night that these trade unionists were killed. And we believe, and Francisco Ramirez, a trade unionist who was quoted in the Times, believes they could have stopped these killings and did not.
And the relation of U.S. aid to Colombia with what's going on in this particular situation, then I want to go back to John Ross in Mexico and ask him about Colombia's centrality in the Monterrey meeting.
Well, first of all, Drummond itself has been one of the companies in the forefront of asking for more aid to Colombia. In addition, as you know, Bush has now said explicitly wants aid to fund military units to protect companies in Colombia that are extracting resources from Colombia, particularly oil. And so our concern is, in the case of Drummond, that the very military units that Drummond uses to protect its coal mines are at night also the same paramilitaries that commit these types of atrocities. There's similar concerns with the military units that are being used by Occidental Oil and the Arauca region.
John Ross, can you wrap up with us about how Colombia fits into this picture and why Bush is making this trip to Latin America now?
Sure. Pastrana was, Andres Pastrana, the Colombian president, was met with both Fidel Castro in the short period of time he was here, and George Bush and Vicente Fox. So clearly, the Colombian situation was playing a role behind the scenes. There wasn't a lot of talk out front on Plan Colombia. But, you know, let's remember that Vicente Fox has developed a plan that's called the Plan Puebla to Panama, an alleged development plan that takes us all the way from south of Mexico City to Panama, in terms of allowing in and promoting U.S. investment in the energy sectors all over Latin America. And through with the Plan Puebla to Panama, the Plan Colombia picks up right there, you know? So I think we're looking, and there was a lot of talk about Plan Puebla Panama at the summit in Monterrey. So I think we're looking at two sides of the same situation. Again, we're seeing this resurgence of U.S. attempts to dominate Latin America. Those of us that have worked here for years and years and years are you know, this is a kind of cyclical event, and it's happening all over again. Amy, I might add that, you know, what the big expectation about Bush's visit here was that some sort of an agreement was going to be revived around the immigration issues. Immigration was torpedoed, essentially, by 9/11. No announcement was made on any kind of agreements. It appeared that both sides were stymied, that Bush is not willing to go back to where he was before 9/11 and deal with amnesty for 3 million Mexicans that are in the United States and opening up the border. And I think that was a big omission at the summit here. Plus an announcement about the development of what they're calling an intelligent border. It's those oxymoron to me. But indeed, the United States is now emplacing these enormous machines, which X-ray railroad cars and trucks, on Mexico's southern border, not on the northern border. So the U.S. is becoming responsible. Vicente Fox has allowed the U.S. to become responsible for vigilance on both Mexico's southern border and on its northern border in the United States. And I think this is a development that we need to keep watching.
John Ross, thanks for joining us from Mexico City. And finally, to our guest in the studio, the executive director of CSPACE. You'll be involved with the major organizing, the anti-war mobilization going on in Washington, as well as the protests against Plan Colombia, April 19th to 22nd?
Definitely, and if people want more information about that or more information about our organizing against the Central America Free Trade Agreement, which is being carried out in alliance with organizations throughout the United States and Central America, they can contact us at CSPACE on the web. It's www.cspace.org.
And that CSPACE stands for Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador. I want to thank you very much as we move on now to the issue of independent media in our next segment. Stay with us.
And CNN will spread the lies. This is just how it's gotta be. They can have their CNN, 'cause we've got our IMC. And we'll tell the truth quite clearly, though they don't want to hear it. And they'll try to stop our broadcasts, 'cause the truth is that they fear it. We'll shut them down. We'll shut them down. We will shut them down. And we will build a new world without the corporate elite. And we will see the day of their international defeat. We'll have self-determination and equality for all. For what choice do we really have but to rise up and see them fall? We'll shut them down. We'll shut them down. We will shut them down. We'll shut them down. We'll shut them down. We will shut them down. We'll shut them down.
David Rovics will shut them down. And he'll be joining us tomorrow as well. You can go to his website at davidrovics.com for more information about his music. Yes, we've been blessed by two live performances in our studio today. Colleen Katow and Jolie Rickman, their CD, Sing It Down, and David Rovics, putting the Oscars to shame. Well, for those of you who stayed up last night late, it was the 74th Annual Academy Awards. We'll be talking about more about this in future programs. Yes, it was entertainment industry's big night, Hollywood's prom. Also, some significant firsts last night. Halle Berry won the award for Best Actress, becoming the first African-American woman to win the award in the Oscars' 74-year history. And when they were clearly giving her the signal to wrap up, she says, just a few more seconds. We've waited for this for 74 years. She won for her role in the movie Monsters Ball. In the Best Actor category, Denzel Washington took home the Oscar, only the second time in Oscar history an African-American man had won that award. The first was Sidney Poitier, who was also honored last night for his brilliant and barrier-breaking career in film. Well, lest anyone think that too much had changed in the world of Hollywood, the Oscars on Sunday night also served up plenty to disturb, as did the year in movies in general. It was a year dominated by just three or four big production conglomerates, as well as more multi-million dollar mediocrities than one cares to mention, a trend that'll no doubt be repeated and even intensified in the years to come as the Federal Communications Commission and its chief, Michael Powell, push for ever more industry consolidation. When President Bush appointed the son of the Secretary of State, General Colin Powell, Michael Powell, as the head of the FCC in January, he effectively became chief steward of the global information economy. The younger Powell is charged with overseeing the entire spectrum of electronic media and communications and comes to the job at a pivotal moment. After two decades of consolidation, scores of media companies have been reduced to six global conglomerates: AOL, Time Warner, News Corp, Sony, Viacom, Vivendi Universal, and Disney. Four telecommunications companies own the lines into nearly every home and business in the U.S. AOL Time Warner commands nearly a third of total hours spent online, more than Microsoft, Yahoo, and the next 17 companies combined. And as digital convergence blurs the boundaries among cable, telecom, and the internet, the pace of consolidation is picking up. Last year, Congress overturned a long-standing rule limiting the percentage of the market a cable operator can control. Powell could have appealed the order, but instead he launched a study to see if any cap is justified at all. When questioned about his pro-big business policies, Powell ironically declared, "The night after I was sworn in, I waited for a visit from the angel of the public interest. I waited all night, but she did not come." Well, this weekend, the angels of the public interest descended on the Washington office of the Federal Communications Commission. On Friday afternoon, media activists gathered to serve Powell notice that they will oppose his efforts to further consolidate big media. They say Powell was appointed to serve the public interest. Instead, he does the bidding of the media elite. This footage was shot by Simba Russo, one of Democracy Now!'s filmmakers and camera people. We'll go to that footage later, but we are joined in the studio by one of those who protested this past weekend. He is Petri Dish, and he is a pioneer in pirate radio. He's with Prometheus Radio Project, a not-for-profit dedicated to the democratization of the airwaves through the proliferation of non-commercial community-based micropower radio stations. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks for having me on.
And thanks for coming into the firehouse. Tell us about the protest, your major objections on that cold Friday afternoon that you gathered.
Oh, it sure was cold. We decided, when we saw that quote from Michael Powell, we felt that it couldn't go unmet, and it wasn't the only thing that he said. He said that he expected the angels to bring him a crystal ball, and to be able to tell what the public interest was in media. And he later said that the marketplace is my religion in a speech a little while ago. And we just thought that it was about time that we got religion too in this whole debate over media. So over the past month or so, we've faxed the office every couple days with a message, something like, "Hark ye, the angels of the public interest are coming to serve you notice about what the public interest in media is," and we felt that it was very important that he get the message, that the courts get the message, and that the rest of the commissioners get the message that the marketplace cannot solve every problem in media, and that we need a vibrant public interest sector, and we really need to stop the consolidation of media as it's going now.
Can you explain this decision by Congress overturning the longstanding rule limiting the percentage of the market a cable operator can control, and what this means for public access?
Well, there have been a number of really serious decisions over the course of the past year. Of course, in 1996, Congress took away many of the traditional regulations that we had that prevented concentration of media. The worst, the one that I know best in radio, they took away the rules that capped national ownership on ownership of radio stations, and now we have empires, whereas we used to never have more than, one or two stations owned by a single owner. Now we have empires where Clear Channel owns 1,200 radio stations across the country. The most recent blow to the regulations on media and on media ownership was a court decision that threw out some of the regulations about cross ownership of cable and broadcast TV stations, and that was and they also told the FCC that they had to reconsider the ban on cross ownership between the owner of a daily newspaper and a cable network, and that's a very serious thing. In my town, Philadelphia, for example, the two daily newspapers are owned by the same company, the Inquirer and the Daily News. And the cable market is dominated by Comcast. At this point, if that regulation goes, the cable company could buy those two newspapers, very conceivably, and we could end up with really one corporate owner dominating the vast majority of the media that reaches into Philadelphia.
We're joined also on the phone by Jeff Chester, Executive Director of the Center for Digital Democracy. Your major concerns as you protested outside the FCC?
Well, a handful of media giants have a concerted effort, as been said, in the courts with Congress at the Federal Communications Commission to overturn the existing safeguards on media ownership for both old media and also to ensure that they can control the Internet as well. What you have now likely to pass is that, as was said, a handful of companies will be able to own significant parts of a community's media environment, the newspaper, the cable company, the principal Internet service provider, several TVs and several radio stations. But because these same companies have lobbied at the FCC to end policies around the Internet, which ensure open access, non-discriminatory access to the Internet, this concentration is all about controlling the future of America's digital communication system. It's really about transforming the Internet so that it will no longer be a significant threat to these interests, but principally come under their control, or that they will be given significant gatekeeper control over how the Internet evolves. We may be having a problem here, it sounds like.
No, we're doing fine, but we're going to try to go to a little of the footage of the protest at the FCC. We'll give it a second try.
Ken. Malcolm X said the media is the most powerful entity on earth, and I do agree with that. In the 1930s, the Supreme Court ruled that the FCC was responsible for regulating the airwaves in the public's best interest. It's become pretty obvious that the FCC has become irresponsible with that mandate. I mean, the CIA and the Pentagon, they sit on the boards of these news organizations. That's why we get the kind of coverage that we do. The airwaves, and this is no small detail, are the property of the American public, and they do not belong to Michael Powell. They do not belong to Rupert Murdoch. They're a public commons like the oceans or space. The FCC has leased out the airwaves to a handful of billionaires who serve the needs of the corporate fascist empire, and that is not about to change unless the American people assert their demands and reclaim what belongs to us. Freedom of speech means nothing if you cannot communicate freely and uncensored as a nation and discuss the various crises we've inherited. Why do you think days like September 11th happen? Because the American public are not involved in their government's foreign policy. They are not informed. They are kept out of the decision-making process. And unless we want to see more days like that, we better get involved and reclaim the communications infrastructure. Michael Powell is the son of Colin Powell, who was a general during the Persian Gulf War, where the United States deliberately targeted civilian infrastructure, and the media kept that hidden from the public. That is the same reason most Americans do not know that we killed more people in Afghanistan than that died in the World Trade Center. Civilians, not terrorists. And that butchery is going to keep happening until we get involved and reclaim and discuss the truth with each other as a country.
And that was War Cry speaking outside the Federal Communications Commission. She is with the Indy Media Center in New York. Final words for Petri Dish.
Well, what we really want to do is we want to just slow down the concentration of media ownership. Under the stewardship of Michael Powell, we feel that the media landscape is just going to go way downhill. And I mean, if Michael Powell was a city planner, he would pave over Central Park and put up another Times Square, and he would take all the corner bodegas and turn them into Burger Kings. We really can't have a media that is solely dominated by marketplace interests. We really need sort of green spaces and open spaces, the kinds of spaces created by independent media centers and the independent media. And that will not be able to survive in a world that has so much corporate ownership.
And 30 seconds, where does your organizing go from here?
Well, we've managed to win a few things over the course of the past year or two. The Low Power FM service is starting up. And
that is?
That is small community radio stations, mostly in smaller towns around the country, that are being allowed to have licenses at this point. And it's the first expansion of the world of community radio in the past 20 years. Last month, we just put on the first radio station onto the air that has ever been owned by an environmental group in the country. And we think it's going to be great to have environmental organizations, civil rights groups, and those sorts of groups as stewards of the airwaves. We're going to put another one on the air in Oroville, California, later this month, and we're really excited to see community radio blossoming again. And
if people want to get more information, where can they go on the web?
Go to www.prometheusradio.org.
Petri Dish, thank you for being with us with Prometheus Radio Project, a not-for-profit dedicated to the democratization of the airwaves. Jeff Chester of Center for Digital Democracy in Washington, War Cry, was there at the FCC in Washington, D.C. That does it for the program. Go to our website at democracynow.org for all contacts. Our email address is mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Miranda Kennedy, Lizzie Ratner, Jeremy Scahill. Anthony Sloan is our music maestro and engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
Prey on us when we sleep. Oppression. You chase after the tired, the poor, the weak. Oppression, you know you mean only harm. Oppression, you reach out with your long arm. But oppression, I won't let you near me. Ah, no. Oppression, you shall learn to fear me. Yes, you will. Oppression, you seek population control. Oppression, to divide and to conquer is your goal. Oppression, I swear that hatred is your home. Oppression.
pressure.